jullie toch vandaan?
Waar de slurpenhuisjes staan.
Hebben jullie ook een eigen taal?
Ja, die spreken wij allemaal.
Doen jullie iets wat wij niet durven?
Ja, want wij zijn echte smurfen.
Dit is een lied met een leuk refrein.
Jullie zijn groot en wij zijn klein.
De fluitsmurf begint. Ja, zing maar na. En nu de tweede stem. En nou allemaal. Kunnen jullie door een waterkraan?
Wij kunnen door een waterkraan.
En ook door een sleutelgat?
Ja, ook door een sleutelgat.
Kunnen jullie op een blokfluit spelen?
Ja, daar kunnen wij ook op spelen.
Vinden smurfen dansen fijn?
Ja, maar alleen op dit refrein.
La 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 la. Wie is daar verkeerd aan het smurven? Hey, zing eens netjes mee.
Yes,
waarom zijn de smurven klein?
Omdat jullie groter zijn.
Gaan jullie met die muts naar bed?
Ja, die wordt niet afgezet.
Gaan jullie net als wij ook slapen?
Nee, wij moeten driemaal gapen.
Wat is jullie grootste wens?
Smurven, maar dat snapt geen mens. La 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 la.
Am Samstagabend macht jeder sich fein, denn in Dorfwirtshaus ist wieder Tanz. Schneeweiße Tische, Girlanden und Blumen, der Saal strahlt in festlichem Glanz. Lachen und Stimmen und Gläser, die klingen, die Stimmung ist wieder famos. Und unsere Viermann-Kapelle stimmt die Instrumente und dann geht es los. So'n alter Schunkelwalzer, den man nie vergessen kann. So'n altes Schunkellied begleitet dich ein Leben lang. Ja, so ein Unterpaar ist wunderbar für alt und jung. So'n alter Schunkelwalzer bringt dich gleich in Schwung. Der
der Kellnerin mit ihrem schneeweißen Schürtchen ruft man die Bestellungen nach. Sie hält das gefüllte Tablett hoch empor und kämpft sich durch Menschen und Krach. Die Tochter mit 16 sitzt bei ihren Eltern, sie darf heute dabei sein bis 10. Ein Junge lacht über die Schulter ihr zu und die Mutter, die soll es nicht sehen. So ein alter Schunkelbalse, den man nie vergessen kann. So ein alter Schunkellied begleitet dich ein Leben lang. Ja, so ein Untertan ist wunderbar für alt und jung. So ein alter Schunkelwalse bringt dich gleich in Schwung. Um 12 gibt es noch einen Dusch und die Musiker kriegen Applaus. Dann packen sie die Instrumente zusammen, die Leute gehen langsam nach Haus. Der Wirt stellt die Stühle noch selbst auf die Tische, die Kellnerin fegt das Parkett. Draußen ruft man sich auf Wiedersehen zu, heute war's wieder mal richtig nett. So ein alter Schunkelwalzer, den man nie vergessen kann. So ein altes Schunkellied begleitet dich ein Leben lang. Ja, so ein Untertau ist wunderbar für alt und jung. So ein alter Schunkelwalzer bringt dich gleich ins Schwung. So ein alter Schunkelwalzer, den man nie vergessen kann. So ein alter Schunkellied begleitet dich ein Leben lang. Ja, so ein Untertan ist wunderbar für alt und jung. So ein alter Schunkelwalse bringt dich gleich ins Schwung. So ein alter Schunkelwalse, den man nie vergessen kann. So ein alter Schunkellied begleitet dich ein Leben lang. Ja, so ein
Hello and welcome to the Eurasian Knot. I'm your host, Sean Guillory.
And I'm your fellow co-host, Rusana Novikova.
The Eurasian Knot is sponsored by the Center for Russian, East European, and Eurasian Studies at the University of Pittsburgh, and you lovely patrons out there who give us monthly contributions to help us keep this podcast running. As I've said repeatedly in the last couple of months, your generous donations are increasingly important. So please consider becoming a patron by going to patreon.com/euronaut or to the podcast website, euronaut.org, and find the link to Patreon and sign up and just give us a few bucks. It's very helpful.
Foundations of Social Theory at the Interdisciplinary Program.
As you said.
Yeah, classical text. So I'm excited about that because it's actually social theory. This semester we taught Marxism.
Liberalism. That was actually interesting.
Well, fortunately, I didn't because I was on maternity leave. I didn't have to deal with it.
Oh,
so I literally came back the week that they started talking. Hey, where are the...
I think I don't know. Do
you
I have
need,
some...
You
like,
need some sound machine. No, yeah.
Do I have some... No, that's not good. Let's see. Wait. Actually, I like that one.
Yeah.
Me too. Okay, that's a...
Oh, this one is pretty good too.
Oh God. Stop. Okay.
This is like giving me a Super Bowl vibes.
Yeah, I don't know if I have a drum roll one, but let me see. Maybe there is a drum roll. Large robot. Oh, no, this changes my voice. Oh, no, I don't have drum. Oh, that's strange. Okay. Well, I might keep some of those in. That might be fun. Anyways, the winner is a listener named Christoph, who I now know lives in...
Laughing. One of them, still giggling, says, "Man, this was really, really good. Oh, I really need to write this down. Okay, so what's your name and your address?" Yes, this was pretty good.
This is a good one. Well, thank you, Christoph. You'll be getting a prize in the mail, hopefully sooner rather than later. I don't know what the state of mail is now with the tariffs and stuff. I don't know if this will matter, but yes, you can send it to us. You can send it through our contact page at euronaut.org/contact. And if you're sending a sound, tell us what it means for you. If you're sending a joke, even, you can tell us what it means to you. And we're looking for jokes, we're looking for like jokes from communist societies. It can be from anywhere in the world, like the one that Christoph sent in and won our prize. It's about Hungary. So if you have any jokes from other communist states, we'll, because she actually went around and hung out with them. She went on a couple of graffiti like painting nights and just hearing of, which is, I mean, the book itself has like over 100 pictures of graffiti. So it was really cool.
Wow, that's impressive. I bet they were really nice places to hang out in.
I bet. So, and you know, to hear about like, particularly in authoritarian states, like what role does graffiti play and its the politics around it and its political efficacy is something else that we talked about that I found interesting. So, yeah. All right. Well, why don't you go ahead and introduce Alexis for us?
Alexis Lerner is an assistant professor of political science at the United States Naval Academy. She's the author of Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States, published by University of Toronto Press. You can see the Alexis Gallery of Graffiti at postsovietgraffiti.com. Here's Alexis Lerner.
All right, Alexis, it's great to talk to you. Thanks again for reaching out and letting me know of your book. I guess John Bushnell's book on graffiti, I mean, that's the only one I knew of. So it's just you, him and yours now?
That's right.
Okay. And his book was published, like, I have it somewhere over here on my shelf.
In 1990.
It was published a long, long time ago. So I guess this is a topic just waiting to be picked up by someone, that someone being you. And your book is called Post-Soviet Graffiti, Free Speech in Authoritarian States. And, you know, the first question I have is, why graffiti?
Thanks so much for having me. I should offer, before we start, a general disclaimer that the opinions and statements in this interview are my own and not those that reflect the U.S. Naval Academy or the Department of Defense.
So back in 2009, I was an undergraduate and I was living in St. Petersburg, Russia. And every day I would walk with my roommate along Nevsky Prospect all the way down from my apartment to St. Petersburg State University to on the island. And as we did that walk, we would see all of this graffiti, these stencils, stickers, freehand writings about jailed political prisoners, about nuclear policy, critique of nuclear policy, and so on. And it was all really free and critical of the Kremlin. And it led to these bigger questions of, well, is this just a St. Petersburg thing? Is it true beyond St. Petersburg? Is it true outside of Russia? And so I went back to the States and I went back to school and I started getting funding to go back to the region. And I ended up going all the way from Berlin in the west to Vladivostok in the east over the course of 10 years, looking at how people express themselves using graffiti, how they circumvented censorship in a variety of different types of regimes, but of course with a focus on how they do it in the most closed of regimes in the authoritarian states.
So as we were talking briefly before we started recording, your book is the only book I know of besides John Bushnell's book on Moscow graffiti from 1990, which he deals with a bit of the late Soviet period. Why don't you give us a brief history of graffiti in this region that you've looked at?
One of the coolest things about doing ethnographic work is that you, over time, talk to all of these people and you get to sort of cross-validate the stories they tell. And so one of my interviewees is this guy named Basket, right? I use their pseudonyms that they choose for themselves as graffiti artists. And Basket told me this amazing story of it's the late Soviet era. He's sitting in a cafe in St. Petersburg. And if everybody's pretty, especially young adults, they're looking for something to do with their time. And he's sitting there all day drinking the same cup of tea. And there's a TV in the corner and they have a VHS of Beat Street. And if you've seen the movie Beat Street, it's about breakdancing in New York City. And in the back of all of the breakdancing, you see the trains of Manhattan covered in graffiti. And that was really powerful for Basket. And so he connected with his two friends. They go over to Riga where they can find, you know, the paint factory. And so they go to the paint factory and they get the paint. They bring it back to St. Petersburg. They start painting. And he tells these stories that some babushka was walking by and how she commented on what they were painting. And there wasn't this immediate aversion because there was no precedent really for it. I mean, John Bushnell, as you say, he talks about it a bit. And he talks about, for example, the hippie movements as shown through graffiti and some of the nuclear movements. Certainly some of the Viktor Tsoi graffiti happening in the late Soviet era. But this real explosion of graffiti used to express political discontent and political sentiment is huge in this like early post-Soviet period. Then these guys go on to create a school of sorts, right? So they start training the next generation of artists to, and of course they're often paid to be there. So they train the next generation of artists in how to paint and how to create something that I guess in 2025, we turn to YouTube or social media to do. But you know, at that time, this happened in person. And this next sort of second gen artists, they came to paint in a time that not only were they being trained by people who sort of learned by doing, but also they came to become artists in the time of these graffiti festivals. And these graffiti festivals were initially sponsored by these international corporations. So Nike, Nescafe, Monster Energy Drink, even the U.S. consulate at some point, I think it was in 2011, sponsored one of these. And all of these different organizations would have their own agenda and they would bring these artists to paint a skateboard deck or a pair of shoes or whatever. They were often told no politics, no porn. And they would create and they would be given, you know, paint and they would be given space to make art. Of course, they were completely taken advantage of and these international corporations then used their products and used their art in order to make a profit overseas. So they were learning from the first wave. They were getting more experience through these festivals that were very popular at the time. That brings us to sort of the present day where we have conservatism, nationalism, patriotism. There's a closing, a consolidation of the authoritarian state in Russia. This is post-2022. There's tensions between the U.S. and Russia. There's sanctions. There's a proxy war in Syria. There's all of these different things happening that create sort of a crackdown. And so what happens with the third wave is some of those second wave artists and even first wave artists are invited to quite literally come out of the shadows and paint on behalf of the state. These beautiful large murals about Maya Plisetskaya and like national Soviet icons and different cultural leaders, but also about military leaders. I'm sure you've seen maybe on the old Arbat, there's this big mural of General Zhukov looking out over the Arbat and sort of over Viktor Tsoi, the Tsoi wall where people would come there and write peace-sick graffiti. And so you had these artists that were being invited to paint for the state explicitly. Anybody who wanted to create real subversive art was sort of pushed to the outskirts of society. So that's the trajectory of graffiti from the early 90s, late 80s until today.
I don't know if they talked about this at all, but I'd be curious to know if they did. You know, in the Soviet period, street art, of course, was widespread in terms of the state's propaganda. Did they reflect upon that Soviet tradition of a state sponsored, in this case, again, street art and the kind of messages that they were trying to provoke with that propaganda?
Oh, 100%. And so we go from any, you know, a Soviet consolidated autocratic state to a post-Soviet consolidated autocratic Russia. And we see these trends from both time periods of the state using these sort of six-story murals, which dominates public space. It co-opts artists, it co-opts the art form, and it's able to control narratives. And so, yes, someone walking down the street might think, oh, that's just a pretty colorful image of Maya Plisetskaya. I did a talk a few weeks ago, and one of the women in the audience said, oh, I was a ballerina in Moscow, and I remember going with all my ballerina friends, walking down the street, seeing Maya Plisetskaya. We used to take selfies with it. And, you know, yes, in some ways, there is a plausible deniability that it just beautifies this space. But there's also this bigger story of when you see this, it tells you which sort of leaders you're supposed to glorify, what sort of narratives are supposed to be dominant. And surely that's reminiscent of the Soviet era. Absolutely.
You say this in one point. You said that street art is a narrative of a place, right? It's supposed to, as you walk through that space, it's supposed to make you understand that space in a certain way. Can you talk a bit more about what you mean by this narrative of a place?
One of the most wonderful things about graffiti is how highly localized it is, especially when it's political. And so, for example, in Riga, Latvia, there's the Lady Liberty Monument sort of in the middle of town that exemplifies everything about being, you know, Latvian independence and celebrating being Latvian. And there's this very nice image, well, nice, there's a very detailed image of Lady Liberty going through a meat grinder. And this idea that it's a critique on the European influence for Latvia and the Baltic countries to make their own identity small or even non-existent, unrecognizable, in order to be welcomed by the European state or the European mass. And so that's maybe specific to Latvia. Whereas in Berlin, in Germany, in 2014, I'm seeing images of Holocaust survivors jumping rope with barbed wire, which is, we know that in Germany, people do talk about the Holocaust in schools and with young people, and it is a part of the national narrative. I saw, for example, in 2011, kind of literary and cultural figures as celebration of the Belarusian people, despite the state's ties, you know, as opposed to the Belarusian state and its ties with the Kremlin. In Osh, in Kyrgyzstan, there was a lot, especially in 2010, about the ethnic conflicts happening between the Uzbek and Kyrgyz people in that town. And sort of they would say, well, Uzbek people aren't allowed to trespass in this area. Kyrgyz people aren't allowed to trespass in this area, and so on. So there was a lot of derogatory graffiti at that time. And of course, in Moscow, right? So you would see a stencil of Peter the Great in an artist district with the words, a tsar will only be a tsar as long as one believes him to be a tsar, right? And so this just this very highly local idea of what matters in a place. I also always believe that graffiti has this role of circumventing censorship. So it depends, what are the issues? What's the hierarchy of issues being censored in the first place? So in one place, it might be ethnic conflict, whereas in another place, it is, I don't know, talking about Putin in the political leadership, or in another place, maybe speaking about minority issues like the Holocaust, you know, or something in Berlin. It's also true outside of the post-Soviet region. This is by no means unique to the post-Soviet region. We have all these abandoned buildings and abandoned post-industrial spaces, and you would see graffiti referencing Hurricane Katrina and how it damaged New Orleans back in 2005, and how that is so drastically different than what happened with post-industrial collapse and white flight and riots in the city of Detroit. And so you have this highly local story of whatever the political issues are for that community.
And you also have a struggle, being, like you said, it's a way to circumvent censorship. And it's, so it's a struggle over like who belongs in that space, who owns the space, not own in terms of property, but who owns in terms of who has the right to speak or to be there. And then, of course, you get into this cat and mouse game of you get graffiti and then it's painted over, and it's this constant kind of narrative battle.
Yes, but there's agency in that. So yes, you see a narrative battle of if it says Lukashenko sucks on the wall of a bus stop in downtown Minsk, it's going to be gone really fast. But if you see Jews are vermin on the wall of a Jewish day school in Budapest, it might stay up for 6 weeks. And I think this tells us something really important about government agency too. What is tolerated and what is not tolerated? And that differs state by state as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a really good point. So you talk to a lot of these street artists, interview them about their craft, their art. Why don't you tell us about some of them? Who are they? What's their background? As you said, like you made the reference to Beach Street, you know, a lot of graffiti is inherently connected to a variety of different kind of marginal subcultures. Where do these people fit in?
I'll tell you a little bit about how I found these people. I used couch surfing. It was this tool for people to find other like-minded people who wanted to open their home to strangers. There were a lot of gatherings among couch surfers. It was a whole thing. So I went on couch surfing and I would look up, right? And I would look up all the different cities where I was going to go. I was going to go to Budapest. I was going to go to Moscow, whatever. And in every single place, I would look at who was in that location and talked about graffiti or street art in their profile as one of their likes, right? You would hyperlink their likes. And I would reach out to them. And for those that responded, I would give them this sort of very quick questionnaire. And they would tell me what areas I should go to, who I should speak with. You know, is there like a so-called graffiti wall? Like in Prague, there's Lenin Wall, where everybody would come together and kind of write if they wanted. And I would talk to these different people. And I would, if they were amenable, I would talk to them a little bit further. And ultimately, I would make these maps. And I would make a map of every single city I went to. And each map would have six locations. It would have an artist area, a downtown area, a student area, a market area, sort of an end of the line area where we take the train or subway out to the end of the line, and a so-called graffiti spot where graffiti was approved to exist. So again, Lenin Wall or Five Points in Long Island City kind of place. And I would go to the area, I would go to Moscow, and I would go to all these different locations, and I would collect all the different graffiti that existed around there. And I would also ask these people on couchsurfing, would you show me around? And often they would, and I would go around with them for the whole day. And then I would ask them at the end of the day, will you introduce me to somebody else, the graffiti artist community? And over time, I was able to develop relationships with these people. So I would go back to Moscow year after year after year, and I would get together with these people. We would have kids. Our kids, you know, would come over each other's houses. And it was really, it's really nice.
What types of people are they?
They are all kinds of people. They are, some of them are wealthy. Some of them are not wealthy. Some of them are women. Some of them are men. The women in particular would often say that they were able to, they believed, get away with some things that their male colleagues weren't able to do. There's one woman in Budapest who would draw different graffiti just right out in the public, and she would wear kind of a construction worker vest. And she said nobody ever bothered her. One young woman in Moscow once told me that she got picked up by the police and she was very worried. And they took her to the police station and they asked her to make a mural. And so she went in the police station and she drew a mural for the officers there.
Let me ask you about this, because like even the word, say, graffiti, at least in the American English context, it has all sorts of connotations, right? It has to do with like urban decay. It's coded with like hooliganism or vandalism. And then street art, when something is called street art, it inevitably has a higher kind of aesthetic appeal, right? A more artistic. Do you make a distinction between these two terms, or is it important to make a distinction, or are they just interchangeable?
Well, I acknowledge in the book that in the art history world, there is an important distinction between these different works, of course. Street art is anything from fancy murals to someone taking off the top of a fire extinguisher and painting onto a wall to someone using moss, right, that grows over time to paint. There are lots of different ways to create public art. And of course, graffiti generally has this implication that it's illegal, it's subversive, it's destructive, it's ugly.
It also has racial connotations in the United States.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And also gang affiliations, that it's sort of just a turf war and people are just identifying where their space is and who's not allowed there. I do point to that in the book. That said, I'm interested in the messaging therein. So I'm an equal opportunity viewer, and I would consider mosque graffiti and fire extinguisher graffiti in the same way I would look at freehand drawing and stencils. I would consider them stickers, for example. And so when I would return from a trip, I would organize my data set of tens of thousands of images, and I would organize each image after every single trip by a bunch of different parameters. And so I would look at the theme therein. You know, is it political? Is it about fascism? Is it about veganism? What's it about? I would look at the language, if there was language. I would look at the location, again, those six areas of a city. I would look at, do we know the artist? I would see if there was, what kind of wall it was on. Was it like a underpass? Was it a subway car? Was it the door to an entrance somewhere, whatever? I would also look at, of course, the date. And I would also look at whether it was legal or illegal or unknown. So whether it had actually some kind of ownership indicated in the corner. So we often see that with some of the murals, especially today. And what I could do here is I could look at the themes across images, which let me compare stickers and stencils and murals for the content rather than for the actual type of art.
Mm-hmm. I want to go back to something you said earlier in recounting this brief history of the culture. Street art does kind of straddle this line, right? Between it can be highly subversive, it can insert a narrative that is not hegemonic. At the same time, it's also easily subsumable within, say, advertising or other types of aesthetic expressions, decoration, etc. For these artists that were engaging in this kind of double game of, on the one hand, they're getting potential jobs, getting paid to do advertising art for corporations and these festivals, getting recognized. And, you know, I would imagine some of these same artists are also engaging in this more subversive type expression. Did they see a tension between these two? Like, how did they make sense of being part of a consumerist aesthetic versus this more political aesthetic?
I love Befton, and I talk about him quite a lot in the book. I use the chronotope. So, I don't know, for the sake of listeners, the chronotope, this idea that there's a spatial and there's an intersection of time and space, but also it intersects with the viewer. And it's specifically in regard to narratives. So this is me reading graffiti again for the political content or the content at all as a form of narrative. So in the book, I come up with three different chronotopes to apply to the book. The first is the midnight graffiti chronotope. This is the idea that these artists are going out in the middle of the night. They are doing so. It's illegal. They can get in a lot of trouble. They can get caught. They're using paint that maybe they bought, maybe they stole, right?
And some of these cases, it's really dangerous. Like, I see graffiti, I'm like, how did they get up there? Like, they actually take risk in terms of physical risk.
Certainly, and there are always accidental deaths, of course. I hear about these all the time, and it's very, very sad. It's very tragic. There's actually an artist in Ukraine called Mustang Wanted. He does this amazing risk graffiti where he goes to the top of these massive buildings and paints at the very top of them. So I have this midnight graffiti chronotope, this idea that people are going out in the middle of the night. They're creating sort of a narrative that exists in a certain time and space. It is explicitly illegal. It's anonymous. It's temporary, right? So we have that cat and mouse that you talked about before with the police or the authorities. That is totally different than this like chronotope of the corporate world, right? So the space is the same. They're walking the same streets, but it is when one ends at, let's say, 6 a.m. with sunrise, and the next one starts. And then when that one ends, the first one starts. So they are completely different temporal spaces, but they exist in the same space. So yes, these people going to work or dropping their kids off at school or catching the subway, they are engaging with the writing on the wall, but in a completely different way than those artists that existed that kind of build that space overnight. And then I have the chronotope of the graffiti festival, which is a combination of the two, if you will. And so this is the idea that these festivals that I talked about before, Nike, Nescafe, Monster Energy Drink, these early festivals ended up becoming the Ministry of Culture, the City of Moscow, and so on. All of a sudden, these are the festivals that are sponsoring these murals. And these festivals would happen during the day. They would have live music or music of any kind, drawing attention to these people. They would provide the paint. So no longer does anyone have to carry their own paint or find it or pay for it or steal it or whatever. There are food trucks at the festivals. Their children are welcome to hang out at the festivals. They have lifts available to raise them up higher in the building. So it is super visible. So all of a sudden, we're taking those artists that were operating at night in the dark, in illegal conditions, writing anonymously, and we're bringing them out of the darkness. We're bringing them into the light, and they are writing for the state. It is no longer anonymous. Everyone knows what their name is. It is not temporary because now we have permanence. These images that go up for the Best City in the World Festival in the city of Moscow are still there 5 years later. And stuff that was illegal is now legal. It's sanctioned. It's curated. It's owned. It is absolute commodification. And this is something that I see with these festivals 100%. And this idea of how the chronotype works with it is fascinating to me. And of course, we saw the early stages of this at the floor, you know, women's clothing ads and graffiti, or like a concert that was 6 months ago, but they can't take the graffiti off the ground or something. So you would see a lot of that in Russia, but it ultimately became sort of something that the state picked up on. And it's literally true. The state in the corner of these giant victory murals about victory in World War II or lifelike depictions of an army general from the Red Army will have thing in the corner with a QR code or a little logo that says paid for by the Ministry of Culture, paid for by the city of Moscow.
Right. Is it within these, you know, I don't know if you've ever participated in a variety of subcultures and how internally regulatory these scenes are. This is something that interests me a lot. Is there a lot of debate and maybe even kind of factionalism between those people who are willing to quote unquote sell out and those who are like, no, man, I'm not going with the government. I'm not going with the cops. I'm going to continue doing this midnight art that you're speaking about, this, you know, illegal type. Is there like a debate within the scene over this?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. There is a debate. And so there's this famous, I mean, this debate started a long time ago before the government started co-opting these murals. And someone named Kirill Kotov, that's his, again, self-designated pseudonym, he would say, if you are writing on the wall, I love Victoria, or, you know, this is my crew, you are not only adding unnecessary noise to a public space, but you're actually performing tacit approval for the government because you had an opportunity to use your voice and you chose not to. And so there was already this debate going on. That said, there are many artists that were painting for, you know, small retailers and whatnot. I'll tell a story. I was in Moscow, again, with Basket, and I was so excited. This man is so well-known in the graffiti circles, and he invited me to go out painting with him one night, and we went to the end of the line, and we went around the subway system, and we picked up snacks, and we got, you know, the paint and whatever, and we're going from subway to subway, and we're going through an alley and through a courtyard and up a flight of stairs and through a door, and we end up getting into this warehouse. So excited. All right, great. We're here. You know, at this point, it's 1-2 in the morning. And he's painting the wall of an off-brand Apple retailer.
Were you disappointed?
And I was there for hours. I mean, great guy, right? And I think I brought this up to other artists and I would say, how do you understand this? And they said, you know, people have to feed their family. You have to make money. And so, you know, we don't look down on other artists for doing that. Though, of course, I already said Kirill Kotov, who says if you are creating art that isn't explicitly critical of the government, then you are part of the problem. There is a debate. And then there's a second element of this, which is the reality that if someone doesn't want to participate with the government with these festivals where they're told no politics, no porn in order to participate, the Kremlin will go abroad and bring artists from France or bring artists from Brazil in order to paint these images. By the way, Maya Plisetskaya is painted by Cobra. Cobra's not a Russian artist. He's a Brazilian artist. And so we have the opportunity to outsource support Kremlin contractors, if you will, in order to shape these public narratives.
Somebody kind of walking through it, you know, just regular person kind of going about their day, you see some political graffiti, and let's say it's kind of, you know, profanity, things like this. For some people, they might say, oh, wow, that really connects to me, right? Kind of what you said earlier about at least Katrina was quick, like that, just like, wow. But other people just see it as defacement, as vandalism. How do you go about reading? Like, if somebody listening to this interview, next time they encounter some graffiti, what is the method that you use to read it?
I come from the baseline assumption that there's no space for what is called art for art's sake in a hyper-politicized world. Especially true in autocratic states where access to free information and free media is limited. But if I see, for example, I'm walking down the street in New York City and I see something about this person running for local office or this policy issue or anything, again, I'm seeing that it's contributing to local conversations in a way that maybe we used to do before people stopped using the public space to engage with each other. And this is why, in some ways, it becomes so valuable. So there, in Budapest, there's this common, it's actually a political party now. It was this group called the Two-Tailed Dog Party, and it started as a graffiti crew, and they would put up really absurdist slogans, things about, you know, the dogs are coming down, the two-tailed dogs are coming down from the alien mothership to change, whatever it is, you know, using absurdism, sometimes for the sake of absurdism, but ultimately as a commentary on politics. And if you know their other work and you can connect them with their other work where they, for example, kind of the parliament building of Hungary upside down, or critique the other political parties for their support of like pre-Trianon borders or whatever it is, right? When you know an area well enough, you can sort of identify who's the artist from the aesthetic and you can see what else they've done. That doesn't necessarily apply to someone writing vulgar, you know, words for the sake of vulgar words. But there is some capacity to link certain images with other images by that artist. And I reiterate that in my take, there is absolutely no space for art's sake. This idea from art history of art for art's sake, it doesn't exist in a politicized world.
Can you say more about that? Because I want people to be clear, on at least including myself, on what you mean by there's no, I think I understand what you mean, but tell me what you mean by that.
It takes great personal and professional risk to go out and create public art, whether you're a performance artist, a dancer, a singer, or a graffiti artist, a writer of literature, to put yourself out there and say something critical, or say something at all, or say something not explicitly pro-state, or whatever it is that you choose to put to where you choose to hang your hat. And so some will say, some in the art history world, there's a debate that you can look at art just for sort of the aesthetics, the lines, the shapes, the colors, the attention to color theory, and so on. But when it comes to graffiti, and especially because of the authoritarian context in some of these countries, you have to consider the political context. It comes out of something very politicized. And I don't think you can look at someone commenting on Roma people in Prague without understanding the politics of the time and how people of certain minority groups are treated in Europe, for example. So you have to have sort of this full picture, this holistic understanding in order to put it into context.
In these authoritarian societies, how is graffiti dealt with? Because I can imagine a multi-layered approach. So, for example, on the one hand, you have this kind of corporate disciplining that you spoke about earlier. You also have the issue of some of this stuff is being put on actual property. Cool. And I can see property owners trying to erase or minimize this type of art when they don't want it. And then, of course, there's the state itself. How does it work in an authoritarian state? Because the assumption is, because it's an authoritarian state, that art is more subversive than if it was in a, say, liberal democratic society.
Well, the issues that come up in a liberal democratic society and authoritarian state are going to be vastly different, right? So we see a lot of shift from regime to regime. In a liberal democratic state, we might see a lot of work about gentrification and corruption, certain, even calling out certain individuals for being corrupt. Whereas in more autocratic societies, those political critiques are going to be a lot more directed about the individual, their political party, and in some cases about the policies, in some cases about just a call for democracy more generally that often comes up in your most consolidated states. I would say there's a difference here in your hybrid authoritarian state and your more consolidated. By hybrid, I mean, I don't know, Russia back. Graffiti in those situations was almost like a pressure valve that people could express themselves a little bit creatively and politically, and perhaps it would result in less likely that, you know, something big would happen. Some large, I don't know, demonstration or regime change or whatever. But more recently, in these more consolidated states, there's just a total crackdown. In 2020, in Belarus, there were these like DJs, right, who played this song that was critical of the state, and someone created in like apartment block number 3, they like made this sort of mural of these two DJs. And these two DJs, the state removed it, that people put it back up, the DJs got in trouble. There was a back and forth. It became very contentious. There were demonstrations that happened in that space. And this idea that even something, just a mural of two DJs, became so hotly contested. And I would say today, especially post-2022 in Russia, I mean, I'm sure you know that any kind of dissent, especially early on, was very, very heavily contained, quickly and strongly contained. People would write, you know, in the snow, just the word no, and they would find themselves in trouble. And then the consequences are different from place to place. So in some places, the consequences for writing graffiti are much stronger than others, of course. But I personally noticed that people that had never been to prison, or to jail rather, were jailed after 2022 for creating graffiti. So there's a hierarchy of topic.
Yeah, and the situation makes something more politicized than it would be in other, you know, periods, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, your book contains, I think it's over 100 different images of various graffiti, which is greatly appreciated, because I'm sure one of the problems of writing about something visually is being able to, the reader to be able to see it. I have this problem with people listening as well. But of all of those, all the graffiti, which I'm sure is in the thousands and thousands, is there one that has stuck with you that is like your favorite? And if there is, could you describe it for us?
Oh, that's so fun. I have three that jump out in my memory. Two are from Moscow. One is from Mukachevo in Ukraine, then Hungary, previously Hungary, where my family's from. And so the first is a picture of I Love Independent Courts, I Love Free Speech, and it is stenciled onto a wall. It's in March 2012, and I love it because at the time I knew how to shoot on 35mm. It just came out so beautifully, and you can see how the day was really wet and kind of warm while the snow was melting, and this woman is smoking a cigarette inside with the window sealed shut, you know, looking out. It's just got this great energy to the picture. And to me, the idea that someone had to use subversive graffiti to make tongue-in-cheek critiques of the lack of political institutions or the failure of political institutions was so poignant that you had to write, I love free speech, on the wall in a state where you clearly don't feel like you have free speech, or you have, I love independent courts. So what a strange thing to highlight in the streets. But again, anything that's not coming out in the mainstream media and the nightly news, those are the sort of topics that we see coming out on the walls. And so that was really powerful to me. It was right outside of a subway station. The second, I think, is actually the cover of my book. And this was also March 2012. This was election season, of course, and there's a lot of graffiti happening during this time. Here I have a picture of Putin, and he's cutting the letter R off of the word revolution to turn it into evolution. This is obviously a time when he wanted to remain in power. This is during the part two of the Great Switcheroo. And any kind of demonstration that led to political change was really threatening to him and his ability to maintain power. And there's also sort of this evolutionary element, like looking backward on our greatness and kind of forward at the same time of how can we evolve to become the uber human, right? The perfect person and create a perfect society. So on the book cover, the press and I took the scissors and put them right across the post from post-Soviet. And so what it does is it cuts the word post off of post-Soviet, indicating the same message that there's this desire to return to a time in the past when post wasn't a part of the story, right? When there was Russian dominance and we were part of sort of some united regional entity. And I thought that that was really, really powerful. And I loved that. And then the third one is, before I went to Ukraine the first time in 2011, I remember sitting sort of at my parents' house at a table and my grandfather was there. And we were using Google Earth to look at the town where he came from in Munkach, Rukachevo. And he had been forced to leave Munkach as a young man. And he went on the Kessler train and ultimately left during the Holocaust. And he had written before he left his name on the outside of his home. And he showed me on Google Earth how to find his home and where his name was. And I went and found it. And it was still there, which was so cool to me. However, it was surrounded by six-pointed Jewish stars, which he hadn't done. And so I thought this was so interesting because, first of all, it shows that the story goes from first person, I lived here, this is my home, to third person, this is the kind of person that lived here, you know, the sort of person that previously lived in this home. But second, it indicated something to me about agency and this idea that hateful graffiti would stay up in the public space for years while political graffiti would be removed within hours. And the state has agency. It can decide what exists and what doesn't exist. So that was really, really powerful and poignant to me and gives us some insight, I think, into the state's priorities.
Yeah. Wow. That's incredible, I have to say, to be able to, your grandfather's name is still there after all of those decades. Wow. Now, you mentioned a few minutes ago, this issue of safety valve. Right. And this question comes up all the time. I mean, it's a question that comes up, of course, in which is, at what role does this subversion play? Is it merely this kind of period? And in this case, with graffiti, perhaps it's spatially a period of turning authority on its head. But at the same time you turn authority on its head, you kind of re-inscribe authority, the authority being turned on its head. Or is it actually a way to mobilize people politically? Does it have some sort of efficacy that you see? Can you comment on that issue of like, well, somebody will just say, yeah, this graffiti is nice and everything, but come on, it's not really that penetrating politically.
I taught the book this semester with a class of seniors, and this was a topic that we talked about often, right? This kind of gives you your integrity and it makes you feel like you're contributing in some way, but does it actually do anything of value or worth in changing the political system that you're frustrated with? And they would often turn toward the internet and sort of changing the picture when you change your profile picture and this idea of, well, does that change anything? Perhaps, you know, that doesn't lead to an answer there, but I thought that that was a really interesting connection that they made. And I will say it brings to mind two examples, one of the group Partisaning, which operates out of Moscow and, of course, is now, you know, dispersed all over the world, and the Strategy 31 program movement. So Strategy 31, I'll start with the second one, is like a group that meets on the 31st day of every month, the 31 days, and kind of like talks about what they're frustrated with civically. Of course, in peacetime, that looks different than in wartime. And oftentimes these groups were closed, shut down by the authorities. But there's this picture I have of Peter the Great trampling the then mayor of St. Petersburg, who was understood to be Kremlin affiliated, with, you know, the location that they would meet and the time, and, you know, 6 p.m. on the 31st of the month. And this idea that you can understand the oppositional tone from looking at it. You see this sort of picture of Russian identity damaging, I don't know, this idea of civically, like what it looks today to be Russian, at least politically. And you know the oppositional tone, you know where to go, you know who might be there. You maybe heard about it in the news. So you do have this mobilizational element. And I think it does have some kind of efficacy beyond just preserving one's own integrity. For example, the Partisaning group, which I interviewed back in 2012 and started connecting with earlier than that, and they're still dear friends, they would say, well, We're just surveying local communities, trying to see what they need using graffiti. We're just painting zebra stripes across busy thoroughfares. We're just recreating the subway map to make it more realistic. We're just doing local things to serve the local community. And you would say, but like, isn't it political? And they say, well, how is it political? Perhaps if you influence the way that people see themselves in their local community and the degree to which they care about their local community, it will change the way they vote. But at this moment, nobody's talking about Putin. And I don't know if that's plausible deniability to protect oneself or if it's the truth, but there is that element too of someone saying, yes, we are immensely effective, but on a very local level.
And I guess maybe the question is, something makes me think, and based on your answer, maybe the question's the wrong question. Because on the one hand, here you have the graffiti is identifying a community. Like, you know, I connect with that. That speaks to me. There are other people out there like me, right? Mm-hmm. That maybe I can plug into in a more meaningful way. And the second is the word you keep coming back to, and that is agency. In a context